Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin our program with a couple of daily selections from the November issue of Science of Mind. We're still looking forward to receiving the January-February issue. And I don't think I told us before, but this month's guides were written by Reverend Dr. Jim Lockhart. Why are you so enchanted by this world when a mine of gold lies within you? Rumi. My inspiration for this month's daily guides is the spiritual reality of unlimited abundance. The universe is unlimited. The potential for abundance is unlimited. Although we are all subject to limitations in consciousness, we also are capable of changing and eliminating these limitations. We accomplish this through rigorous and regular spiritual practices that direct our subconscious beliefs to a greater acceptance of the good that already exists as potential. Abundance is ours when we allow it. Dr. Jim Lockhart is a minister emeritus and a practitioner of religious science. He served on the Religious Science International Board of Directors for 9 years and was instrumental in the integration of RSI and United Church of Religious Science into Centers for Spiritual Living. Since retiring from active ministry in 2015, after 20 years, he traveled extensively and currently lives in Lyon, France, with his wife, Dorianne Cotter Lockhart, Ph.D. Lockhart's current ministry involves writing his blog, New Thought Evolutionary, and all one word, New Thought Evolutionary, .wordpress.com, writing books on spiritual leadership, and conducting personal coaching for spiritual leaders. Abundance 101. You are not separate from the whole. You are one with the sun, the earth, the air. You don't have a life. You are life. Eckhart Tolle. We say we are one with God and one in God. This is a mistake. We are one of whatever the nature of God is. Whatever it is one. Ernest Holmes, The Philosophy of Ernest Holmes, page 85. The creation of the universe contained within it everything necessary at that instant, and the potential for everything that would be necessary for its continued existence and evolution. Nothing was missing. And as expressions of that universe, you and I are made of the same stuff, that which was present at the instant of creation, that which has come from potential into form during the life of the universe thus far. We also have access to the unlimited potential that has not yet been actualized. Our future is bound in the future of the universe. This rich birthright is available to everyone, is part of everyone. But we must discover it for ourselves. We must find our way, discovering ourselves and our divine natures as we go. Some, it seems, are born into situations where this discovery is highly unlikely, while others, such as you, dear reader, have come into possession of the great truth of self-discovery. Our teaching, Science of Mind, is one source of this truth, built from the wisdom of the ages and expanded through a modern understanding of psychology. Our great gift is that we have this teaching available. To bring these principles to life, we must keep studying the teaching and practicing its principles in our own lives. Affirmation. I know I am one with the richness of spirit at all times. I accept this as the essential relationship of my life and receive its blessings. Abundance 102. The good news is that the moment you decide that what you know is more important than what you have been taught to believe, you will have shifted gears in your quest for abundance. Success comes from within, not from without. Ralph Waldo Emerson. It seems to me that our evolution is a result of an unfolding consciousness of that which already is and needs but to be realized to become a fact of everyday life. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 387. Abundance is an elemental aspect of the universe we live in, and therefore it must also be an essential element of who we are. I cannot be unlike that which created me, for I'm made of the same stuff as all of creation. We live in a universe of cosmic possibilities and potentials, a universe that contains within it the necessary intelligence to actualize these potentials into form and experience. Each of us is a center of this intelligence, actually a disturbance in the field of all intelligence, created to actualize potential according to who and what we are. This gets to the heart of our very reason for being, to actualize potential into our uniquely human experience. Your guess as to why that is the way the universe was created is as good as mine, but here we are. abundant beings in an abundant universe designed to actualize infinite potential using an innate intelligence shared with all of existence, but localized in an individualized way in each of us. Wow. When we accept this birthright, when we fully own our own nature and potential, we live lives of fulfillment and contribution to the greater good. We experience a healthy consciousness and encourage others to do the same. We expect life to go our way in general and are not knocked off balance when it appears not to. Affirmation. My nature is goodness. My nature is abundant. I direct my experience from a place of high expectations, accepting the natural bounty of the universe in which I live, move, and have my being. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, Epiphany. The light of divine love and wisdom shows me the truth of my being. Matthew's Gospel tells the story of the star that guided the wise man from the east to visit the newborn Jesus. Epiphany reminds me that this story from more than 2,000 years ago is alive in me. Like the star that guided the wise man, the light of divine love and wisdom guides me to a growing realization of the Christ presence within. As my awareness of my divinity grows and I deepen an understanding of myself as a spiritual being, I grow more comfortable and confident living from my spiritual center. Knowing I am one in God, Spirit, the universe, helps me see the divinity of all others. How my experience of the world changes when I elevate my awareness in this way. As divine beings, we are here to love one another and to create heaven on earth. Protected. I find my protection in my divinity. Unexpected or undesirable developments may leave me feeling afraid and unsure what to do. This is when I must hold tightly to my faith in God and Spirit in the universe, and my understanding that the presence of these is not just with me, it is within me. Trusting in this protecting presence within calms my heart and mind and reminds me I'm never alone. It also empowers me to seek the circumstances I need to make myself feel safe. Mostly, I realize my spiritual protection lies in my awareness that I am blessed with many spiritual gifts. My faith, wisdom, and dominion allow me to meet life with a sense of security and safety. I am blessed to lead a God-centered, spiritual-centered life and to know and trust in spiritual protection. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, The Spoked Wheel. What we reach for may be different, but what makes us reach is the same. Imagine that each of us is a spoke in an infinite wheel, and though each spoke is essential in keeping the wheel whole, no two spokes are the same. The rim of that wheel is our living sense of community, family, and relationship, but the common hub where all the spokes join is the one center where all souls meet. So as I move out into the world, I live out my uniqueness. But when I dare to look into my core, I come upon the one common center where all lives begin. In that center, we are one and the same. In this way, we live out the paradox of being both unique and the same. For mysteriously and powerfully, when I look deep enough into you, I find me. And when you dare to hear my fear in the recess of your heart, you recognize it as your secret that you thought no one else knew. And that unexpected wholeness that is more than each of us, but common to all, that moment of unity, is the atom of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Not surprisingly, like most people, in the first half of my life, I worked very hard to understand and strengthen my uniqueness. I worked hard to secure my place at the rim of the wheel, and so defined and valued myself by how different I was from everyone else. But in the second half of my life, I have been humbly brought to the center of that wheel, and now I marvel at the mysterious oneness of our spirit. Through cancer and grief and disappointment and unexpected turns in career, through the very breakdown and rearrangement of the things I have loved, I have come to realize that, as water smooths stone and enters sand, we become each other. How could I be so slow? What I've always thought set me apart binds me to others. Never was this more clear to me than when I was sitting in a waiting room at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York City, staring straight into this Hispanic woman's eyes, she into mine. In that moment, I began to accept that we all see the same wonder, all feel the same agony, though we all speak in a different voice. I know now that each being born, inconceivable as it seems, is another Adam or Eve. Sit with a trusted loved one and take turns. Name one defining trait of who you are that distinguishes you from others. Name one defining trait of who you are that you have in common with others. Discuss how you cope with the loneliness of what makes you unique from others and how you cope with the experience of what makes you the same as others. We return now to the November issue of Science of Mind for Reverend Dr. Sony Cantrell Smith's monthly column, Everyday Spirituality, Shape the Abundance of Tomorrow. As we stand on the threshold of November, a time associated with harvest and reflection, this is a good time to consider the spiritual concept of abundance. Nature in all its wisdom offers us profound lessons about abundance, lessons that seem particularly relevant as we approach the U.S. election. This time of year, when the earth is rich with the fruits of our labor, reminds us that abundance isn't about material wealth. Abundance is a state of mind, a perspective on how we relate to the world around us. Nature shows us that abundance is not an all-or-nothing game. In a forest, trees coexist, growing in proximity, each receiving sunlight, nutrients, and water. The leaves that fall become nutrients, feeding the soil, which in turn nourishes the next generation of plants and trees. This cycle of giving and receiving, of nurturing and being nurtured, reflects a truth we can carry into our lives. Abundance grows when it's shared. As Americans prepare to cast their ballots, this lesson from nature is worth contemplating. The election is a pivotal moment, not just for who will lead the country, but for the values that will guide us in the coming years. Will we choose leaders who understand that abundance is amplified when it is distributed equitably? Or will we lean toward those who view abundance as something to be accumulated and hoarded, often at the expense of others? Just as nature thrives through balance and reciprocity, so too can our society. The decisions we make today, both in how we care for the earth and in the leaders we elect, will shape the abundance of tomorrow. Regardless of the election's outcome, the wisdom of nature remains clear. True abundance is inclusive, sustainable, and rooted in a deep respect for the interconnectedness of all life. As we move forward, let's embrace this perspective, recognizing that our collective well-being depends on how we nurture and share the resources available to us. Today, I celebrate and share my unlimited abundance and embrace the interconnectedness of all of life. And from the same issue, an article by Julie Moreau, Prayer Alone is Not Enough. When justice work is not charity, then it is not true justice. And when charity work does not promote justice, it is not, finally, charity. Richard Rohr. One of Ernest Holmes' most powerful statements and a guiding light is, change your thinking, change your life. Now that you're changing your thinking, how and when will you take action and implement those changes? This challenge from Reverend David Goldberg, Ph.D., asks us just how we intend to put our changed thoughts into changing our lives. Changing our thinking clearly is the crucial first step. By itself, however, it may or may not actually change our lives. Once we change our thinking, then the hard work begins to make the changes required. Every single day, one change after another. A further challenge asks us how we'll put our prayers and meditations into doing the actual work, not just to change our own lives, but to create the world we hope and pray for. St. Augustine posed it this way, pray as though everything depended on God, work as though everything depended on you. Some scientific studies demonstrate the efficacy of praying and meditating, terms that for our purposes here will be used interchangeably, including intercessory prayers offered on behalf of another. This magazine previously published features and columns regarding these studies, and a simple internet search reveals them as well. My purpose here is not to challenge whether or not prayer works. Rather, I suggest that just as faith without works is dead, so too prayer without action ignores our duty to get off our prayer mats and dedicate ourselves to the hard, often relentless work of creating change. What the Mennonites know. Each activity of daily life in which we stretch ourselves on behalf of others is a prayer in action. Richard J. Foster. My father grew up in a small Mennonite farming community in central Nebraska. He firmly believed in concepts Mennonites have embraced for centuries, the importance of faith, the uncompromising power of prayer, and the obligation we as a familial, communal, and global community owe to each other. In his town, when it came time to plant or harvest, when a neighbor needed an extra hand, when the town needed a larger church or a new school, each community member engaged in some way in support of another. Yes, they prayed for each other, But when the time for prayer was over, they dug in and got to the actual work of helping, of supporting, of building community. When tragedy strikes in another part of the world, as it is today, Mennonites organized relief missions, not just to send food or clothes or handmade quilts, but to send carpenters to help people to build buildings, to send farmers who help farmers, to send teachers for school children. And they've been doing this for centuries because it literally is part of their religious tradition. When my dad visited the bereaved or took part in prison outreach programs or mowed the neighbor's lawn, he did so quietly, accepting no payment, and he did so because his faith required it of him. He became an answer to someone else's prayer. While I may disagree with many of the religious dogma and beliefs espoused in the Mennonite Church, I grew up understanding from my dad that this is how we do faith in action. This is what we do after we say amen. We roll up our sleeves and figure out how we can help. Expand from the micro to the macro. The gold standard for assessing justice in society is whether the widows and orphans are cared for. Daniel Wolpert. How easy it is when a friend is sick or grieving or in dire straits to say, I'm praying for you. And the person for whom you pray is grateful, sometimes beyond all measure, for your kindness, for your concern, for your prayers. But are your prayers enough? Do you reach out to someone who is ill and see how you can help? Can you give them a ride to an appointment? Bring them a meal? Sit with them to relieve their caregivers? Do you read to them, sing to them, pray with them, and not just for them? When my partner's health began failing 3 years ago, he and I were deeply grateful to each person who prayed for him and for me. We appreciated their concern and compassion. And when he passed in January, I was ever more grateful for those prayers, whether the person offering them believes as I do or not. But the most healing and comforting gifts we received were phone calls from loved ones, a visit from a friend, a card in the mail, a meal dropped off on the porch. Those truly felt like answered prayers. We likely all know the quote from Desmond Tutu, "There comes a point where we need to stop just pulling people out of the river. We need to go upstream and find out why they're falling in." When we center ourselves in prayer and then take time to look upstream, we can find ways to step into the gaps through which people fall. We can reach out to those whom society marginalizes and bring our compassion, our activism, and our hearts to heal those who've been harmed while we figure out how to dismantle the systems that destroyed them to begin with. In her book, Untamed, Glennon Doyle writes, "Let's keep pulling folks out of the river forever, and every single day let's look upstream and give living hell to the ones pushing them in." To do otherwise doesn't just disrespect our prayer practice. It literally is spiritual malpractice. Amen. And prayer is meaningless unless it is subversive, unless it seeks to overthrow and to ruin the pyramids of callousness, hatred, opportunism, falsehoods. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Doyle's nonprofit, Together Rising, creates strategies for changing the problems created upstream. "We must commit to pulling our brothers and sisters out of the river," she writes, "and also commit to going upstream to identify, confront, and hold accountable those who are pushing them in." She recounts praying for and holding parents of gun violence victims, and then going upstream to fight the gun manufacturers who profit from those deaths. Her nonprofit funds recovery programs for those addicted to opioids, and they work for change in the profit structures that benefit from those addicted. The lesson for us, I believe, is not to turn away from prayer or from meditation, not to turn away from raising our vibrational impact on a broken world, but to center ourselves through meditations and then turn to action. Have an "and after we say amen" or "and so it is." In his book, Looking Inward, Living Outward, Daniel Wolpert recounts how a church where he was a pastor reached out to a homeless shelter and offered to provide dinner. The congregants arrived, cooked the meal in the shelter's kitchen, sat down and ate with the residents, and then cleaned it all up afterward. The shelter's director told him no other group had done that. The others dropped off the meal and left. Over the years, Wolpert writes, "eating together with families and individuals changed our church members. They saw what life was like for unhoused people. They got to know each other." These meals led directly to social change when members of the church who had the power in the city supported funding for programs to help people get housed, get to medical and dental appointments, and transition out of jail more easily. He concludes, This is how our life with God, Spirit, the universe, works. We pray, we attend, we notice, and we work for the coming of the kingdom where there is justice and peace. And so it is. And from the same issue, Dr. Roger Teel's monthly column, Law of Circulation, Our Hearts Connect in Oneness. Years ago, I saw a movie filmed in the late 1930s called Lost Horizons. It was about a group of plane crash survivors who were stranded in the Himalayas. Miraculously, they meet a guide who gives them warm clothing, then leads them on a journey not particularly far, but difficult. They find themselves trekking up steep, icy paths, all linked together by a long, well-knotted rope. The combined strength of the group would save any one of the travelers who might slip and fall. Sure enough, they were led to a valley hidden deep within those mountains, a land of eternal contentment where gentle people lived together generously and harmoniously. It was called Shangri-La. It is apparent that humanity is currently navigating some particularly slippery slopes. Our extensive challenges are produced by mindsets of fear, separation, hostility, limitation, and inequity. We have learned enough from this needless suffering. It is high time to tap the possibilities of realized oneness. Those travelers in Lost Horizons had three things going for them: a shared belief that they could make it, a spirit of givingness to the good of the total group, and an unambiguous connection uniting them. In these same ways, a higher course is being charted for our Centers for Spiritual Living, publishers of Science of Mind magazine. We're revealing greater dimensions of the beloved community. We are bound together in sacred purpose and committed action. We are circulating our spiritual gifts together. The Bible predicts that each of us is here on earth for such a time as this, here to participate in the momentous quest to radically enhance the quality of human consciousness and livingness. Our journey will be blessed to the degree that we link up in togetherness, deep believing, and generous sharing. To this end, I invite you to open your heart and to share generously at this. And remember, Shangri-La is so much more than fiction. It is the magical terrain we always discover when our hearts connect in oneness. We turn now to the January-February issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an interview by Karen Brailsford, Enlightened Perspectives, Deva Premal and Mitten, How Mantra Heals. Deva Premal and Mitten, M-I-T-E-N, are partners in love and music. German-born Deva, née Jolantha Fries, a bodywork practitioner, and British neighbor Mitten, née Andy Desmond, a former rocker who opened for bands like Fleetwood Mac, met at an ashram devoted to the teachings of Indian spiritual leader Osho in 1990. Together, they create community through meditative musical gatherings, chanting retreats, and Zoom rooms. The symbiotic duo's albums, including 2018's Grammy-nominated Deva, reverberate with her sonorous voice and his harmonic compositions. Eckhart Tolle, Cher, and the Dalai Lama are fans. The couple's version of the Sanskrit Gayatri Mantra is the gold standard. In advance of a world tour that will take them to the U.S. for the first time since 2019, they recently shared with contributing editor Karen Brailsford how mantras heal and why their relationship is still sings after all these years. Karen Brailsford: there's an American children's series called Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? So where in the world are Deva Premal and Mitten? Mitten: we're in Deva's birthplace, in Nuremberg, Germany. KB: I see you as living the dream life because you get to travel from place to place. Is this the life you envisioned? Deva: there was a natural flow where we wanted to travel with the music. Pretty quickly, a migration pattern emerged where we would stay 2 months in Greece and 3 months in Australia, and then a few months in Europe and a few months in America, sometimes South America. We just loved it. We never missed having a home or felt like we wanted to stay just in one place. M: we never set out to create what's happened to us. It just happened. And the music, especially the mantras and the Gayatri Mantra, has taken us on its wings. DP: and then when Corona happened, we found ourselves in Costa Rica. M: for a program. And we never left. DP: we never left. And now we've built a house in Costa Rica, so we actually have a home in Costa Rica. M: at last. DP. For the first time in our lives, we actually have a real home. KB, of course you would end up in Costa Rica, a spiritual hotspot. M, we've been going there 20 years. We've watched many gardens blossom in different parts of the world after all these years, but the Blue Spirit Resort in Costa Rica is where we bring people for groups. It's in the jungle. We have monkeys as friends. It's becoming a little more commercialized as people get to know about it, but the animals are there. You just have to be quiet and let them come to you. KB, Diva mentioned migration. I've been listening to your new live single, All the Birds Fly Home. M, it was one of many songs I liked for my time at Osho's ashram in Pune, India. The spiritually incorrect mystic, as we like to call him, inspired so many people. We would dance with our eyes closed before sitting in silence. It was almost like the birth of rave music before there was any such thing. The song came back to me in Costa Rica, and we started to play it at the end of our concerts. We were there when COVID hit, and so we didn't leave. We had the joy of watching nature unfold in front of us through a whole year. We had a house in the jungle. We watched birds building nests. We watched when the babies came out of the nest to look and open their beaks for food. We also watched their first flight. KB, part of me wants to tease, oh, you poor thing, stuck in Costa Rica during COVID. M laughs, somebody had to do it. DP, we thought, well, we are in this incredible place. What can we give from here? Like everyone else, we went online. Every day for 77 days at 2 or 3 p.m. Costa Rica time, which is when Australians and Americans and Europeans could meet, we sang the Gayatri Mantra, and there were 50 to 100,000 views every day of those meditations. We've heard it was such a lifesaver, an anchor. M, for all of us. DP, yes, for all of us. There was such a strong community. We then said, okay, let's now do it once a week. We haven't stopped in 4 years. M, every Saturday, live. DP, we also decided to give this community a home. So we made an app called Gayatri Sangha. It's become a beautiful, beautiful virtual online ashram. We do everything from holding daily meditations to sharing vegan recipes. M, we also introduce people to other teachers we've crossed paths with and to friends we've learned things from. It's an amazing garden of the beloved. DP, and it's really tangible. Even though it's virtual, you can really feel it. KB, you've always been focused on building community and cultivating a sense of oneness. DP, Osho is our root, and Osho's vision was always very inclusive of all spiritual paths. M, and traditions. The way that I came to Osho was to read one of his discourses on Zen parables. It just opened our minds. We were very young. Well, she was, laughing at the reference to their 23-year age difference. DP, that really informed the way we share the music. We're not Hindus, although we transcribe Sanskrit mantras. It's a healing modality of sounds that have no ideology or belief system attached to them. They're pure sounds. M, we're not just singing rock songs or ballads or pop songs. Every time Diva sings, she's sending healing energy out to the people and to us, too. KB, what is so special about the Gayatri Mantra, and how has it influenced your lives? DP, the Gayatri Mantra invokes the sun, spiritual light, and enlightenment. And because my father chose it to welcome me and my sister into the world, and then chanted it with us every night as a good night song, it's been with me from day one. But I let it go when I was 10 or 11 because I was like, rolling eyes, oh God, mantras, that's my parents, not me. And then I found my own spiritual path with Osho, which didn't include mantras unless you wanted it to. But in my late 20s, the Gayatri Mantra came back to me while I was at an Osho center. I realized that I had this treasure inside of me that I'd basically forgotten, but had been growing somehow within me. Because once I reconnected to it, it just burst forth. It changed my voice, and it changed our lives. That's the version on the 1998 debut album, The Essence, that, like seeds, flew everywhere. M. We've chanted it just about every day ever since. It never feels old. It's a living entity. You never know musically how it's going to unfold. You have a structure, you have a chord sequence, but once the genie comes out of the bottle, you just hold on and let it go wherever it needs to go to connect. KB, when my daughter was young, she heard the Gayatri Mantra one time and immediately knew the words. M, there is definitely something that children tap into. We've met many parents who tell us their children chanted mantras throughout their childhood. It's a beautiful connection. KB, Many say they heal after listening to her music. Meetin, you yourself experienced a healing. M. After my heart surgery in 2018, I was convalescing and found that if I lay down and just trembled, a certain relief came. It wasn't until later when I read Peter Levine, an expert on physical trauma, that I learned that's what animals do when they heal. I carried on for about a week nonstop, and then I had this incredible night of red-hot catharsis. I was screaming and crying, and Diva was holding the space for me like an angel. Toward dawn, I could feel the energy beginning to subside. I was about to say to Diva, "Let's put Osho's voice on. I need to hear him." But before I said those words, a voice said to me, "What about your healing? What about your music?" DP, "Your own medicine." M, Diva put on the recording of the Gayatri Mantra, and we lay down on the bed in each other's arms. Eventually, we fell asleep. When we woke up in the morning, it was like a new day. The sun was pouring through the window. I felt like a newborn. DP, we are receptive to vibration influencing our bodies. It feels like we are bringing sacred order into our system. According to the scriptures, the most powerful way to tune into the mantras and to receive their power is when we think them, not when we say them out loud. They say it's 100,000 times stronger when you think the mantra. The more you become a master of your thoughts and of the mind, focusing that energy just on the sounds within, the more it becomes an inner cleansing, an inner tidying up. KB, I read that you begin your concerts with meditation. Is it your intention for everyone to be thinking the mantra? DP, our whole concerts are a meditation. They just have different expressions of meditation. Some are more up and some are more silent. We usually like to begin in silence to have a breath and just arrive. And then, you know, take it from there. KB, earlier I said you're living the dream life because you get to travel, but it's also because you get to work together. What makes Diva and Meetin work? DP, it's a good question. We'll let you know when we find out. To Meetin, I'm curious about what you're going to say. M, if we knew the answer, we would be couples therapists. We've never had to work at this. We've been together 24/7 for 32, 33 years. As long as I do what she tells me, no problem. That's my message to all the men out there. KB, what do you love most about Diva? M, how long have we got? I would say Diva is as true an angel as I've ever come across in this world. It's not only on a spiritual level, she's also so caring, not just with me, but also with friends and other people. I've watched that all through our life together. I find it absolutely inspiring. And she can sing. Is there a God or what? KB, Diva, what do you love about Meetin? DP, I don't think I could be with someone who didn't make me laugh. Humor is a huge thing. And he's like a shaman. I think that's also why our relationship works. When we work together, there's a clear understanding. I know he's the leader, the shaman in our musical expression. We don't bump into each other because I want to be the leader. Of course, I have moments of thinking, where are you going with this? I have such a deep appreciation of Meetin's love and wisdom. It just doesn't get old. It just keeps being very delightful. KB, do you remember the first time you saw each other at the ashram? DP, I remember being attracted to this very loving being. We have a nice little story which you can tell to Meetin. Shall I tell it or will you tell it? M, you go ahead. DP, Meetin was going on a world tour to all the Osho centers. The Osho Times newspaper had a photo session with the artists. The photographer felt that to reflect the diversity of the group, there should be a blonde in the picture. M, they all had long black hair and beards, even the women. DP, and he found me. M, she was sitting on the wall reading a book. She was literally the first blonde woman I saw. I just walked up to her and asked if she'd be in a photograph for the ashram newspaper and explained it to her. I took her hand and walked her over to the photographer. KB, can you describe how exactly you make music together? DP, I still haven't really found a huge flow of composition. I've composed one or two things here and there, like Seven Chakra Gayatri Mantra from Diva. M, everything is done together. DP, yeah, but the songs, you really write. M, I feel like we tune in together. We're collaborators. There's no one defining way that we can say, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is what our relationship is. It's become so vast. We've learned through Osho's wisdom not to try and manipulate life, but to say yes to it. That's how this happened. It's all a big, mysterious unfolding to find ourselves together after so long and building a house in Costa Rica. KB, you've collaborated with others as well, like India Ari. M, these two great singers got together to chant a Buddhist mantra, Tara Mangalartha Mantra, climate balance. We recorded it and put it out on Spotify. The money it generates goes to a charity that's helping to clean up Mother Ocean, which is in a really bad way right now. Cher covered our Gayatri Mantra on tour. That blew our minds. KB, your original chants are used for meditation, stress management, yoga, massage, and sleep playlists. What's a quick way to calm oneself? DP, remember the power of the Om, sound of creation, mantra. In moments of frazzle, of overwhelm, take one breath and let the sound travel on the out-breath till the end transforms your next one. Do it every night when you go to sleep, first with the voice, then silently in your mind. It prepares you for the next morning. M, actually, now that I think about it, there's one song that really answers your question about Diva and me. It's called Till I Was Loved by You. It says, I never was loved so deeply, never was loved so true, never was loved so completely till I was loved by you. Time can only take away the things our minds have made, but love's glory is no small thing. And I knew it when I heard you sing. I never got to see the man in me till I was loved by you. KB, that's so beautiful. A devotion to Diva. M, well, like I said, as long as I do what I'm told. Diva Pramal and Mitin are Grammy-nominated musicians known for performing contemporary versions of ancient Sanskrit mantras. Between them, they've released more than 2 dozen albums. In 2024, Mitin published In the Garden of the Mystic, Songs of Love, Wonder, and Devotion, a book featuring lyrics from 25 of his songs. Their 2025 spring tour will include concerts in Mexico City, Miami, New York City, Boulder, Colorado, San Diego, Sedona, Arizona, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Vancouver, Seattle, Edmonds, Washington, Toronto, and Montreal. Visit, and this is all one word, divapramalmitin.com. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo/audio/on-demand. And we return now to Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution by Rainn Wilson. We've been reading from this for a few months now, and we had started Chapter 9, The Broken Blue Marble. We are watching the birth more than the death of a world, Father Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And we had gotten just started in the beginning. I'll pick up here where Rainn is saying, as a matter of fact, in one of my many unsuccessful offbeat entertainment pitches, I once proposed a weekly part-scripted, part-improvised podcast about aliens observing human customs, politics, behavior, and society overall. These comedic characters would also end up becoming huge consumers of human media, film, and TV, and use them as ongoing reference points. So bear with me while I indulge that idea here on these pages. For your reading pleasure, I commence with some possible dialogue between two of these alien observers that we'll call Scoobash, and the second one is a bunch of different symbols. So I will just go with the, and we'll just call this being and. And we had started the conversation, but I will start at the beginning of it. Scoobash, any update from your recent aerial flybys and media monitoring on planet Earth? And, yes, we have triple confirmed that humans have full awareness of the imminent and catastrophic dangers of climate change due to heat-trapping gases that they are emitting from a variety of sources. There are articles in all the major newspapers, documentary films, and television specials, as well as research papers from top scientists provide undeniable, verified data. Discussions about the issue are happening in the halls of their immature government gatherings. Occasionally, a little Swedish girl attends these gatherings and yells at the officials, "How dare you!" Scoobash, and well, she should. If they know about the disastrous repercussions of unchecked CO2, nitrous oxide, and methane emissions, as well as rampant deforestation, why are they doing nothing to stop it? I mean, they must also know that they are at the point of no return. And, well, they are bringing their own shopping bags to the supermarkets. Scoobash, what? And, you know, because of the plastic... Never mind. Scoobash, again, what? And, I believe humanity's lack of response to the climate crisis is explained within the pages of that book I sent you, The Lorax. Skubash, loved, and classic, right? Just metaphorically substitute Trefula trees for the Earth's environment in toto. For decades, a vocal, well-funded minority denied climate change was even happening and funded a massive disinformation campaign. Now that that phase is over, the new tactic is downplaying the damaging effects of climate change and extreme weather events. Many of this coterie chalk up all the disaster talk to alarmist chicken littleish doomsaying. But bottom line, they complain about the expense of doing anything about it as implementing green technology, reducing CO2, and transitioning to alternative energy sources comes with a hefty price tag. Skubash, first question, what does Chicken Little refer to? And long story, I'll send over the mediocre animated film starring the voices of Zach Braff and Steve Zahn from 2005. Skubash, ooh, good casting. Also, the expense? Does this species understand the billions in overall expense that catastrophic flooding, extreme storms, persistent droughts, and plant and animal extinction will have? That this completely solvable problem will wreak havoc on world economies over the coming decades? And that time is of the essence? And, yep, Skubash, I'm confused. And, well, this species is not very good at setting aside their immediate wants and needs for the long-term good. They have no collective vision for the future of their species or their planet. Skubash, what about Star Trek? And great show, every version of it. Not a huge Voyager guy, but it has its supporters. Skubash, okay, but wait. Didn't humankind just face one of their worst viruses in history, pull together, create and distribute a vaccine in record time, and save untold lives? Wouldn't that example unite people? And, no. Because of partisan factionalism, no one thinks it's a triumph of collective action in the face of global disaster. Skubash, wow. I kind of can't wrap my head around all these contradictions, and neither can humanity. In fact, much of the world is still governed by authoritarian states that only seem interested in aggressive nationalism and militarism and invasion of neighbors. And the other half, the democratic half, is locked in corruption, ennui, and selfish, materialistic pursuits. They do have a collective council called the United Nations, but it's ineffectual and bureaucratic. It's in a cool-looking building, though. Skubash, wait. They're still at war or threatening and or planning for war? They've lost 108 million of their kind to armed conflict over the last 100 years or so. And I suppose I would refer you to the sequential illustrations I sent of the bald-headed boy child who is repeatedly tricked by a glowering, assertive female into attempting to kick a football. Skubash, okay, war and climate catastrophe aside, what else have you been observing for all these solar years? Give me the lowdown. And, well, a haircut called a mullet just came into fashion again for like the third time. Oh, and here's a fun fact. There are 8 people on the planet who have as much wealth as half of the planet's population. Skubash, wait, what? Can you repeat that? And, yes, 8 male humans in the last quarter of their lifespans are worth $426 billion United States dollars. That's as much as 4 billion of the poorest human beings on the planet. Skubash, I'm sorry. I just don't understand. I'm flummoxed. Why would this be allowed? Why don't they give away their money to the poorer people? Why don't the governments intervene? Why don't the 4 billion people just rise up and storm the houses of those 8 male humans? And, whoa, Scoob, let's not get placed on a watch list here, okay? It's just that many humans don't believe in any economic action that might be seen as potentially limiting job creators and entrepreneurs. But there's a bit more to it. Politics plus racism. Skubash, what's racism? And humans have different colored pigments in their skin and have self-sorted into races, socially constructed groups whose creation and abuse has ultimately caused no end of oppression, injustice, and disunity. Did you read that Star-Bellied Sneetches book I sent you? Skubash, so good. And, well, it's basically that. Skubash, tell me, and why should we not just leave these lunatics to their own devices or simply blow up their planet for them? And, Skubash, don't say that. That would break all 17 of my hearts. These human beings, flawed as they are capable of such good, such beauty. In addition to the work of their most famous doctor, Seuss, the artistry of their various populations is staggering. They've produced masterworks of music, literature, and architecture from every corner of the globe. I mean, perhaps not Orlando, but Skubash. Okay, fine. Stick with it. Maybe they'll get their fecal matter together one of these days. Also, I'm enjoying this Game of Thrones dragon prequel far more than I thought I would. And I know the former Time Lord and Prince Philip now playing that rakish Targaryen is fantastic, Skubash. I mean, it's not Star Trek The Next Generation good, and nothing is, Scooby, nothing is. And so on. You get the idea. I find the idea of looking at humanity through an alien lens to be infinitely refreshing. If one pictures a more advanced life form monitoring our news and media, as well as watching our cultural activities, growth, and conflict on the planet, it opens up a whole new way of visualizing our preposterously misguided and backward ways. Here's an example of one of them. Political ad spending in the United States for midterm elections in 2022 was almost $8 billion. This is for all those idiotic, mean-spirited ads shouting at you that you never pay any attention to on television, radio, and digital platforms, Facebook, Google, etc. And this was during a midterm year. And this is just in one country. Just think about what we could do for education, healthcare, or the environment in the United States with all that money. But we don't discuss this, ever. It's a big, fat, sacred cow. It's free speech and personal expression. It's democracy at work. This amount keeps growing exponentially every election cycle and will continue to expand ad infinitum and ad absurdum. There are thousands of other examples like this. For instance, in a similar but larger vein, global advertising itself in 2022 reached $781 billion. That's TV, radio, billboards, online, and print across the globe. Ads, the lifeblood of capitalist enterprise. The entire reason that my old network television show, The Office, was created, to showcase advertisements for Ford trucks and Dr. Scholl's insoles and Snapple during the act breaks. We will provide you with 22 minutes of entertainment, and you will hopefully watch 8 minutes of tastefully placed ads that don't disrupt the flow of your entertainment-seeking escapism. But think about it. With that nearly $1 trillion, we could fix world hunger, climate change, education, if we, all 8 billion of us, collectively decided to not advertise stuff or things or products or goods or services for only 1 year. I know it's a teensy bit more complicated than that. And of course, one might argue that the $1 trillion in advertising helps drive the economic engine of many more trillions of dollars, jobs included. But surely, naivete aside, if some ad dollars were somehow redirected for philanthropic purposes, somehow the world economy would percolate along just fine, don't you think? The point is, our global priorities seem epically misguided and upside down, and there are countless examples of the absurd choices we humans make on the largest of scales. To combine two uncombinable metaphors so many times, it feels like we're frogs in the boiling water rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. So many of our systems, our ways of doing things, are broken, outdated, nonsensical, unsustainable, and destructive. Sometimes it takes an alien perspective to highlight our collective folly. That are we truly living in folly? Some might disagree with that assessment. There's a school of contemporary writers called the New Optimists, which includes Steven Pinker, Hans Rosling, Matt Ridley, and many others. This best-selling tribe of feted individuals, intellectuals, writers, and TED talkers has one central point to make. The world has made spectacular progress in every single measure of human well-being, and almost no one knows about it, says Pinker. Every day we're bludgeoned by news of how bad everything is, yet we've made more progress over the last 100 years than in the first 100,000, says Greg Easterbrook. And even Bill Gates is in on it. He says, in a book blurb for Ridley, there have been constant predictions of a bleak future throughout human history, but they haven't come true. Our lives have improved dramatically in terms of lifespan, nutrition, literacy, wealth, and other measures. Too often, this overwhelming success has been ignored in favor of dire predictions. And by many measures, these secular, liberal, capitalist-loving writers are right. There are, in fact, far, far fewer people living below the poverty line. In fact, extreme poverty has fallen from 90% to 10% in a century or so. Global life expectancy has dramatically increased, from 29 to 71 years, and infant mortality has dropped from 30% to 3% over the last 100 years. Barack Obama once said, "If you had to choose a moment in history to be born, you'd choose now." And technologically, advances continue to make our quality of life better and better. Think of all the progress made even in the last decade. GPS and touchscreen glass on every phone, blockchains, 3D printing, Alexa, and other smart home technology. And what about all these nifty food delivery apps? Zoom, crowdfunding websites, self-parking cars, cloud-based streaming music and video, instant pots. In so many ways, the new optimists are dead on. And the goal of their work is ultimately to give us hope. Because if we can't see that progress is possible, that humanity can make things better, then why even bother to try and fix the myriad of other problems we face? And yet, as I've posited in the preceding chapters, at the exact same time, here we are with many of those same problems getting colossally worse, not better. In this moment, unlike any other time in history, humanity seems on the verge of destroying itself in about 17 different ways. The stakes have never been higher, and data aside, the world just feels on the brink of collapse. So, which is it? Are things getting better, or are things falling apart? For many young people that I speak to at colleges, these are very difficult dichotomies to process and make sense of. For instance, despite all the controversy around these movements, the Black Lives Matter and Number Me Too tidal waves that swept across the national conversation over the last several years have brought much-needed awareness and slight changes to two of the pandemics I described earlier, racism and sexism. Have they fixed the issues? Not even close. But these were necessary youth-based movements of great power and passion, and I can't imagine we will ever go back to the previous, more diluted way of looking at these vital issues. Progress, not perfection. Conversely, things also seem pretty darn horrific. On the political home front, our democracy seems on the verge of collapse. Meanwhile, increasing extreme weather events kill ever more people around the world, and the disastrous effects of climate change continue to pile up. So, that's bad. The list goes on and on. Revolutionary progress in some areas and never-before-seen destructive setbacks and global threats in others. So what do we put our focus on? The bad or the good? How do we hold both of those world-warping contradictory forces in our mind at the same time? Embedded in the teachings of the Baha'i Faith, there is a key concept that helps me make sense of what exactly is happening in the world right now, how the disparate and conflicting energies of our time are at work in the transformation of human society on a global level. It's relatively simple but astonishingly revelatory. The concept explains that at any time, there are two parallel powers working on the world at once, the forces of integration and the forces of disintegration. In other words, both destruction and evolution are happening at the exact same time. And believe it or not, they are both urgent and necessary. The leader of the Baha'i Faith in the early and mid-20th century, Shoghi Effendi, describes the phenomenon perfectly all the way back in 1938. A twofold process, however, can be distinguished, each tending to bring to a climax the forces that are transforming the face of our planet. The first is essentially an integrating process, while the second is fundamentally disruptive. The former, as it steadily evolves, unfolds a system which may well serve as a pattern for that world polity, commonwealth, towards which a strangely disordered world is continually advancing, while the latter, as its distinguishing influence deepens, tends to tear down, with increasing violence, the antiquated barriers that seek to block humanity's progress towards its destined goal. Emphasis mine. From this perspective, we are headed toward global unity one way or another. Unity of humanity, unity of class, creeds, nations, and cultures. That's the only way forward. It's the only conceivable final result. Remember, we all live on a blue marble floating in space. Whether we almost destroy ourselves along the way or not is up to us, but the ultimate outcome is a human species inhabiting a planet together in harmony. Even if there are only 147 of us left. Much like humanity in Star Trek, we are sometimes gradually, sometimes pell-mell and chaotically, headed toward the creation of a global society that is just, balanced, wise, and compassionate. Anti-globalist fearmongers can doomsay all they want, but the eventual movement toward a unified human family, sharing the resources of our fragile planet and taking mutual care of each other, is what we need to strive for, as naive and utopian as that may sound in these jaded times. But before we get into all that changing the world stuff, there's one phrase from that previous quote by Shoghi Effendi that really pops out: strangely disordered world. And to me, those three words really sum up what a spiritual revolution is all about. Our world is strangely disordered. So much about how we do things, as our alien friends earlier demonstrated, is upside down, backward, and inside out. And things have to change if we want to achieve the mental, physical, and spiritual wellness we long for on a personal and global level. One thing I'm struck by when I read the news is how strangely disordered, how broken all the modern organizational structures are. I mean, what field of endeavor or area of business, society, or government is not broken? Name an existing system, large or small, and chances are it's essentially out of whack at a fundamental level. And this is a good stopping point for us. We will continue in the next few weeks with the rest of this very intriguing, open, honest book by Rainn Wilson, Soul Boom. As always, I ask if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions to please contact the station and ask them to call me or email me, and I can get the information and address it on the program. And as always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I very much look forward to being with you next time on our very own Philosopher program.